Hello and welcome to Razor's Edge, Sydney's independent and local current affairs. I am Miles Holbrook-Walk. Today on the show...
There are a lot of personal and financial stresses, but there's also important things to think about, like if key workers, particularly emergency service workers and police, if they're called in to deal with an emergency at last minute and they live an hour or 2 hours commute from their job, that's really problematic for the city as well.
Key workers like nurses and police officers are being forced out of Sydney. Unaffordable housing prices are pushing workers who are professionally trained and earned fixed, moderate incomes further and further out of the city, leaving Sydney without some of its most essential workforce. And later on, winter sports are often associated with Northern Hemisphere countries, particularly those from Europe and North America. And as a result, the sports on show at the Winter Olympics are often dominated by children of white and wealthy families. But in Pyeongchang, Western Sydney-born figure skater Harley Windsor is set to become Australia's first Indigenous Winter Olympian. All that and more coming up on Razor's Edge. But first, social media is no longer a place to procrastinate from work and stalk your exes. The ability to connect with people all over the world has proved an invaluable resource in the fight for social justice and political change. Ellie Mardridge investigated how the Me Too movement has affected local New South Wales women and how social media functions, and perhaps more importantly, malfunctions, in political movements.
Last year, Twitter feeds and comment sections all over the web were rocked by a short, simple, strong show of solidarity. It came in the form of a hashtag, MeToo. Women everywhere shared their experiences of sexual harassment and assault, harmonising voices to reach a near-deafening roar that broke the internet. And while a display of this magnitude sparked optimism for a brighter future for females, anyone with a Facebook account knows that the internet is not always the most supportive place for discussion.
I'm struggling to see why everyone is so up in arms. She didn't say no or stop.
You do not need to say no or stop for it to be rape.
If he's intoxicated, he can't consent either.
If you're drunk and commit a crime, you still
How is he supposed to know she didn't consent? Read her mind?
I'm not saying be a mind reader, but if you've coerced a chick...
I am so strongly against violence against women, it isn't funny. Having said that, I'm also a man and can imagine being held at the whim.
There's so much shit going on. Who's got the time and emotional energy to
constantly get worked up with being raped? So, what the deluded feminazis here would like us to believe?
So, she didn't consent, but fucked him anyway?
Am I currently in a nightmare, or did I actually just read what's in the comments above?
What you just heard was a Facebook comment thread on an article about a high-profile rape case from early last year. That article was posted after the alleged rapist had already been convicted. I spoke with Karen Willis, Executive Officer of the Rape and Domestic Violence Services Australia, about what social media can offer the victims whose pain motivates these political movements.
It's an opportunity for communities of people who never would have any chance of meeting or getting together, being able to meet in that electronic environment and have discussions about issues that concern them, but also promote them to the broader community.
But although the internet can provide a sense of comfort and community to these victims, it can also act as a trigger.
Look, I think there's two problems when talking about sexual violence, is that just talking about it will have a negative impact on a person who's experienced it, because soon as there's a discussion, somewhere in that person's mind will fly back to their own experience and they will re-remember. And depending on the level of detail of discussion, depending on how well they've processed their trauma, sometimes those memories can be incredibly distressing. Now, even when they're really supportive comments, that can still be the case. When, of course, those comments are derogatory or demeaning or seek to blame the victim, when those things happen, of course, it's terribly hurtful. So it can be hurtful in two ways.
A 2016 study by the University of Southern California observed that a quarter of all comments on online articles about sexual assault are on some level blaming the victim. I asked Karen why she thinks that's the case.
Gender inequity, power and control, and patriarchy, I think, is probably the key answers there. What we know about sexual assault and domestic violence is that the key underlying cause is gender inequity. If we could get equality amongst the genders, we would dramatically reduce to a very small amount the occurrences of this kind of violence. And to do that, of course, there's a whole stack of drivers and there's a range of different things that we need to do. But while we have gender inequity, we will have violence against women and children in the form of sexual assault and domestic violence. So talking about why we still don't have those understandings to maintain that gender inequity, one of the things has been violence against women, and part two of that has been to blame them for what's occurred.
And it seems that victim blaming is less about blaming the victim and more about controlling the behaviour of the masses.
You know, if don't go out walking at night, and then if a woman does and she's sexually assaulted, well, there, we told you so. And the impact of that, of course, is to keep women locked in their homes. Great, terrific. So you can't do night shift, you can't go out to that evening networking party. And if you do and you're sexually assaulted, well, you know, it was your fault. So it is a way of society pressuring women into a certain way of being and doing things, which is, you know, staying at home, only going out with the protection of a man, behaving in certain ways, thinking in certain ways, not stepping outside the lines that are established by the powers that be for their convenience, and of course the powers that be are men. Like,
when asked whether she thinks that a trending hashtag has the capacity to incite real and lasting change, Karen was optimistic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Every time there's a big step, there's a big step and we can't go back. In the 90s, there was a terrible war in the former Yugoslavia. That was the first time that in any big way the reporting about the use of rape as a tool of war actually hit the public headlines. And when you looked at it, the reason for that is that in previous wars, around about 1% of the media correspondents were female. So overwhelmingly it was men. Men told war stories, men tell men's stories. 30% of the media correspondents in the Bosnia-Herzegovina war were women. Women went looking for women's stories and other women told them their stories. All of a sudden, the rest of the world knew that rape was used as a tool of war. So once we've realised that, once that's in a public conscience, we can't go back. With the Me Too, we've now, as a community, said, yes, sexual harassment and sexual assault in workplaces is endemic. And the power and control dynamics that go with it, where bosses use their power and control over staff, those bosses and other people in workplaces being called out, doesn't matter how powerful they are, that's now happened. And we're not going to be able to go back from that. Now, I'm not saying it's going to be smooth sailing, but every step we take, it's now happened and it can't be changed.
That was Ellie Mardrich reporting. Big thanks to Karen Willis from the Rape and Domestic Violence Services Australia for the interview and for the change they make every day. I'm Miles Holbrook-Walk and you're listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. New research shows key workers are being squeezed out of Sydney by a housing market which has left them behind. Teachers, police officers and emergency workers now need to travel to the city fringes to find an affordable home. And commuting into the city is harder and less financially viable than finding work in the suburbs. Many key workers are now finding employment elsewhere. Miles Herbert asked Catherine Gilbert from the Urban Housing Lab at the University of Sydney if Sydney can afford to lose such key personnel.
Their jobs are dispersed basically anywhere where there is an existing population to serve. So they don't necessarily have to live in Sydney, and they certainly don't have a financial incentive to do so. So one of the problems is their jobs are not tied to the city centre or a particular location, so they can move to really access more affordable housing and a better quality of life.
But Sydney needs these workers, right? They need teachers, they need nurses, they need firefighters and policemen?
Absolutely, and I think one of the issues is that key workers don't necessarily need to live in Sydney, but Sydney absolutely needs key workers. I think there's important questions about how the city sort of needs to do something to retain its key workers.
What kind of toll would this take on a worker, and how does that impact their work?
Well, I mean, I think the story is different for different individuals, and I think also age would matter. You know, we found that quite a few older key workers have achieved home ownership. So this is really a problem, particularly for younger key workers. And it would vary for individuals, but we found, for example, quite a few policing jobs are concentrated in the city center, but like 11% of police who work in the city center actually commute from the outer metropolitan region. So they're coming from places like the Illawarra or from the Hunter Valley, and a further 34% are coming from the outer suburbs. So they're commuting at minimum maybe 40 kilometers each way, but possibly over 100 kilometers each way. I mean, that can be extremely costly, if particularly if that journey is by private car, which we did find that the majority of key workers, about 77%, do commute by private car. And it also has social implications and implications for stress levels and things like that. There are a lot of personal and financial stresses. But there's also important things to think about, like if key workers, particularly emergency service workers and police, if they're called in to deal with an emergency at last minute and they live an hour or 2 hours commute from their job, that's really problematic for the city as well.
If that is the case and all the key workers do flood out of the city, what does Sydney end up looking like?
Well, I think obviously there will be still people who are able to potentially access appropriate housing in the city, but a lot of people won't be able to. And I think it'll be particularly problematic when older key workers who are currently housed start to retire, and actually being able to replace those people with younger key workers who can't access appropriate housing in the city. And I mean, the other issue, I suppose, is that you know, while younger people may be willing to live in shared accommodation or accept poorer quality accommodation in order to live in the city, you know, as their lives change, and particularly as people have children, you know, their housing needs change. And that's when I think a lot of key workers will look elsewhere for housing. And that what that means is that particularly hospitals and things in the inner city would spend quite a bit of money training their workers, but then actually those people leave. And so, you know, that's a loss for them.
So how do we go about fixing it?
Well, we've come up with a series of options that we really hope that policymakers and, you know, the development industry would consider. And these aren't, you know, meant to sort of address affordability across the board and resolve the problem, but they could really help key workers to access housing in more locations across the city, and in particular to access home ownership, because that has traditionally been an aspiration of most key workers and something that historically has been achieved.
And you guys talked a little bit about how, you know, the housing slowdown isn't going to solve this issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think over the period that we've looked at, like even since 2006, I mean, house prices have, you know, doubled easily in some areas. And so, you know, even if the market slows down, it would have to slow down significantly to, you know, be comparable to, you know, to wage growth, right?
So this is something we should all care about, right? The fact that these workers are potentially leaving, something that's going to impact us all?
Yeah, absolutely. Personally, I mean, I think everybody, regardless of, you know, what industry they're employed in, has a right to sort of have a home that they can afford and that meets their needs. But, you know, key workers are, you know, that little bit more important in that the services that they provide have really important impacts for the city in terms of sort of social and economic functioning.
That was Catherine Gilbert from the Urban Housing Lab at the University of Sydney, ending that report by Miles Herbert.
Razor's Edge, Sydney's independent news and current affairs radio on 2SER 107.3.
Harry Windsor grew up in Western Sydney, a region that's more likely to be associated with rugby league or cricket rather than figure skating. But Windsor is set to become Australia's first Indigenous Winter Olympian. A descendant of Welwyn, Gamilaroi and Ngarrabal peoples, Windsor is a proud Indigenous man who is defying stereotypes and breaking down barriers. So can Windsor be the inspiration for the Indigenous representation at the Winter Olympics?
The Winter Olympics appears to be a sport that attracts people from around the globe, but maybe there's a tendency for them to be linked in with cooler climate countries, certainly European countries, parts of North America, and I guess, you know, countries in the Northern Hemisphere. But winter sports tend to be expensive, so sometimes you see people who are a little bit more well-off participating in them, but it's not always the case. You know, people who are passionate about it and make it work.
Why is that? Why is the Winter Olympics more expensive?
Well, I think if you just take into account the cost of being at a ski resort, let's call it, particularly in Australia, there aren't huge populations of people who live nearby. So first of all, you've got to pay to get there. And then once you're there, accommodation's usually pretty expensive, as is a lift ticket to ski there. And then food while you're there is also expensive, not to mention all the equipment you've got to buy to take part. So skis or snowboards, quite expensive, thick winter clothing, quite expensive. So all of that would serve as a bit of a barrier to certain parts of the population. And then I guess because Australia, if you're talking about the Australian context, we're quite isolated from other parts of the world where there are bigger and more kind of populated ski resorts. It means that you've got to travel to get to those ski resorts and travel quite a long way. It costs a lot. So that's a bit prohibitive.
Is there also maybe a cultural aspect to this as well, about what sports Indigenous people or people from lower socioeconomic communities should and shouldn't be participating in?
I wouldn't say it's an overt thing. I'd say it's sort of a more invisible and subtle form of systemic, whether you call it racism or just barriers, that does come along with the cost being prohibitive. So that would restrict people from lower socioeconomic communities, not necessarily Indigenous, but just lower socioeconomic across the board. I think the other part of it is winter sports probably traditionally have been associated with people from higher class.
Well, with that in mind, could you tell me a little bit about Harley Windsor's story?
In the area that he grew up, there are other sports that tend to be more popular, the rugby leagues in winter, the crickets, and you know, the accessibility to those types of sports are more common across the population, not just within the Indigenous community. So it's surprising that there hasn't been more participation over time in winter sports by the Indigenous community, and it's something that is worth celebrating, but you know, it also just links in, I guess, with opportunity and there being fewer opportunities to participate in winter sports just based on the area that he grew up in. But, you know, the interesting thing is that it was by chance he got started because he enjoyed the sport, became passionate about it. He followed through with it and did all the hard work to get to where he is. So, you know, I think his story is probably similar to a lot of other elite athletes in the sense that when you find a passion in sport and you really want to persist with it, you do to get to the highest level you possibly can. The slightly unique thing is that he's the first to do it from you know, a broader population that has been around for a long time and also had success in a variety of other sports.
Do you think there'll be an uptick in not just Indigenous participation, but in participation across the board in Australia in figure skating and Winter Olympic sports because of Windsor's story?
I think anyone who makes it to a level of sport like Harley has can have an impact and influence on participation levels, and you'd hope that it would, because sometimes people just need to see that someone's made it in whatever industry, not just the sporting industry, to believe that that's a path that they can follow. It's not that it may have a direct impact on participation straight away, but maybe over time it'll help with people's perceptions about the sport and interest in participating in it. So I think that's probably the broader perspective to take in line with Harley's representation at the Olympic Games.
Andrew Benny ending that report by Miles Herbert. Thanks for listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. You can find all our stories online at 2SER.com/razors-edge. We'll be back again next week, so tune in on Thursdays from 7:30. Razor's Edge is produced on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation. I've been Miles Holbrook-Walk, and thanks for listening.
Lord have mercy. Yeah.